To begin. Pleasure to see everyone once again. Last week we kicked off this series with a session on Rashi, and tonight we're going to jump ahead a century and a half or so, and we're going to move to a different location on the map, and we're going to look at the Ramban, the commentary of Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. So as I did last week, what I'd like to do tonight is begin with some words of biography to set some of the context for who this person was and what it was that he was doing when he set out to write this commentary on the Torah that we so affectionately know today as the Perush HaRamban. So, the Ramban was born at the end of the 12th century, 1194, and died in 1270. I'm just going to put a map up on the screen so that you can see where we're talking about. The Ramban is born, and you have this on the source sheet. Ramban is born or lives most of his life in Girona. And I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. Geography is not unimportant when you study Jewish history and when you study Jewish texts. So Girona is in present day Spain. There was no Spain, obviously, in the 12th century, 13th century, but we have different kingdoms. And one of them is Catalonia. As you can see, it abuts Aragon. And it's just below the Pyrenees, not far from southern France. Okay, so just keep that in mind. We're going to come back to that point in a few minutes. Okay, the Ramban, unlike Rashi, we actually know more about the Ramban's biography in terms of his professional life. He was not only a great scholar and great rabbi, he was also a philosopher and a physician and an astronomer and a Kabbalist. One of the most important events in the life of the Ramban took place in the year 1263. Okay, so the Ramban is already almost 70 years old, and he's lived a relatively untroubled life in the north of present day Spain. And in the year 1263, he was called upon to represent the Jewish community in a world famous disputation. Okay, so this was not uncommon in the medieval period. The Catholic Church was always looking for more converts, and the Jews were a natural target audience. And it was believed that if you could just convince these people to accept Jesus as the Messiah, you'd have a group of willing converts to Christianity. Okay. So Pablo Cristiani was a Jewish apostate, a convert to Christianity, who'd been sent by the Dominicans to King James I of Aragon with the request that the king order the Ramban to respond to charges against Judaism. So the idea is that Pablo Cristiani, who knows the Jewish sources because he was a former Jew, would publicly debate the greatest Jewish sage of the generation. And if the Christian beat the Jew, so what would that mean for the Jewish community? They'd have no choice, so to speak. They'd have no choice but to convert to Judaism. So obviously, it's not a fair fight, and the deck is stacked. And even if you win, you lose, because what's the best case scenario? So it's a totally unwinnable situation for the Ramban. No one is looking to do this because, again, even if you win, then you've just made everyone angry. The Ramban engages in the debate. There's actually a film. We once screened it. I think Avi Schreiber brought it to the Jewish Center. We once screened it maybe 10, 15 years ago. It's called something like The Disputation. And I actually just Googled it, and you can find it. It's on YouTube. It's not a, it, it's not a, you know, award-winning film, but it's actually not a bad representation. If you're interested in understanding a little bit more about this moment in Jewish history, it's not a bad representation of the disputation. We have records. The Ramban wrote a record of the disputation. We have secular records of the disputation. The short version of the story is that they debated whether or not the Messiah had appeared, whether or not the Messiah announced by the prophets in the Hebrew Bible was considered to be divine or born of man. They debated whether Jews or the Christians were in possession of the true faith. And at the end of the day, it was basically the Ramban who emerged as the more compelling argument. But that just made things more difficult. At the end of the day, the Ramban wasn't put to death, right? That could have happened, but he was basically forced to, flee. And after a few years in southern France, he ended up making his way to Palestine, which was a lifelong dream of his, which I'll come back to in a second. Okay, last week I told the one Rashi joke that I know, so I want to tell the one disputation joke that I know this week. A famous story of the silent disputation. I'm sure it's known to many of you. It's 16th century Poland, and same kind of story where the Catholics want to convert the Jews, and they find the most prominent rabbi they can to dispute the most knowledgeable bishop. And they get together and they decide that, they have no common language. The bishop doesn't speak Yiddish and the rabbi doesn't speak Polish. So they have no choice but to have a silent debate. So they begin, and the bishop makes a gesture and he holds up three fingers. And the rabbi responds and he goes like this, one finger back and forth. And then the bishop makes another gesture and he waves his finger around his head. And the rabbi points to the ground. And then finally the bishop takes out his communion wafer and his chalice of wine. And the rabbi pulls out an apple. And at that point the bishop throws up his hands. He says, I don't know how to say this in Polish, but he says, I resign, I concede. The rabbi has bested me. So everyone runs over to the bishop and they say, "What? What happened? Explain to us. Give us the interpretation for this debate." And the bishop says, "I started out by saying, I held up three fingers and I said, this is the Trinity." And the rabbi responded. He held up one finger and he said, "There's a Trinity. It's in your belief system, but there's one God that unifies." That unifies all our belief systems. So I pulled out, I waved my finger around my head to show that God is all around us. And he said, he pointed to the ground to show that, God's not just above us, God is right here with us. And then I took out the wine and the wafer to show that God absolves us of all our sins. And he responded by pulling out his apple to remind me of original sin. There was nothing I could do. He won fair and square. They gather around, the Jewish community gathers around the rabbi and say, please tell us, how did you vanquish this this bishop? What was the story behind this silent gestural debate? And the rabbi says, well, he began by saying that you have 3 days to get out of town. And I responded and said, oh no, we're not leaving. And then he said, he waved his finger and said, we're gonna gather up all the Jews and, deport them. And I pointed to the ground and said, we're staying right here. And everyone said to the rabbi, and then what happened? And the rabbi said, I really don't know. He took out his lunch, so I took out mine. So that's the silent disputation. In the actual disputation, the Ramban won fair and square. He ended up having to flee, as I mentioned, and he ended up in Palestine. It was his lifelong dream to get to Palestine. He never imagined it would happen this way. He had to leave his community, his family behind. And amazing to think what he found when he got to Palestine. What he found when he got to Palestine is what most Jews found when they got to Palestine in the medieval period, which is not much. Palestine had been ransacked by the Crusaders in in 1099, and then again by the Mongols in 1260. When the Ramban got to Palestine, 1267, he said, I couldn't find a minyan. I found two Jews, and they were in, in Jerusalem. We didn't have a minyan. So slowly he died a few years later, but in the time that he was there, he was able to, strengthen the Jewish community. And you can even go today in 2020 and visit the Ramban Shul, and it's been restored. That's the site of the Ramban synagogue that he created when he moved there at the very end of his life. He had a very prolific life. We talked about Rashi just by way of comparison. So Rashi was amazing. He wrote this commentary on almost all of Tanakh, almost all of Talmud. The Ramban wrote on many more diverse topics. So he also has, commentary to the Torah, which will be the focus of our shiur tonight. He wrote a commentary on many Masechtos of Gemara called the Chidushei HaRamban. They're still studied in the, Beis Medrash today, and is considered to be a key commentary among the Rishonim. One of the first, beyond the page of the Gemara after Rashi and Tosfos, one of the first and certainly one of the most preeminent among the Sephardic commentaries to the Gemara that we learn. He wrote other books of halacha, other books of commentary, and some more general works, including drashos and other books of Jewish interest. Okay, so let's turn for a second to the Ramban's commentary on the Torah, which again is going to be the subject of our learning tonight. So when did he write his commentary to the Torah? So one of the ways that we date commentaries. So in the age of publishing, it's easier because people either write the date or we can at least know the date when a book was published. That's almost always included in the on the frontispiece on the title page of a published book. The Ramban is living, 200 years before the advent of printing. So we don't know exactly when he wrote his work, but the best evidence usually comes from references to earlier works. So you can at least know if he says, "Oh, as I explained in my commentary on the Gemara." So you at least know we have some internal reference one to the next. In the case of the Ramban, you have almost no internal references in his commentary to the Torah. But what we do have are manuscripts that demonstrate that he was constantly updating his text. So what scholars believe is the Ramban started as a very young man writing a commentary to the Torah, and he worked on it all his life. He does say that he took it with him when he fled. So we know that, by and large, it had been written already by 1267 by the time he got to Israel. But what's amazing, and you have this on your source sheet, and I'll just show you one reference to this, is that he was constantly updating it. He was constantly updating it because he was constantly figuring out new chidushim and coming up with new information that informed his commentary. And again, much has been written about this, not for tonight, but the Ramban was perfectly happy to include information that he gleaned from his own experience in his commentary. So I'll just show you one example. Here was his original commentary to Bereshis Perek Lamed Hay, where we learn of Rachel's burial. Okay? And he had originally thought that Rachel was buried in Ramah. He got to Palestine, and he went to Beit Lechem, and he figured out that Rachel was actually buried in what we now know as Kever Rachel. And you could see right on the right side of this page is the commentary, the original commentary. And then here you have in this L shape the marginal note where he went back and updated the commentary to include the new information that he had gleaned based on his lived experience of having actually visited the place that was referenced in the Torah. Okay. So really just a fascinating historical note to notice that, this was an organic work. It was a live work. It's not as if, he wrote it and said, this is the be all and end all. It was constantly being updated and constantly being improved And in real time, as we would say in the 21st century, based on new information that came to him in the course of his life. Okay, I want to return to the map for just 1 second. Remember, I said that geography is important in the life of the Ramban. So there's two communities, even by this point, even if they're considered to, it's a little bit of a misnomer, but you have Ashkenaz and you have Sfarad. So Ashkenaz is what we would call today, central and eastern Europe. You have Germany and you have France and Poland and so on. So, and Sfarad are, the Iberian Peninsula, what we have on this map south of France. So there wasn't a ton of interaction in, let's say, the lifetime of Rashi. So how much Rashi knew of what was going on among his contemporary, among Sephardic contemporaries, probably not that much. What's amazing about Ramban, and partially this is because of the geography, so he's ensconced in Sfarad, right? He's living in what we call Spain. And that's the life, that's the heritage, that's the davening, whatever we would associate with Sephardic practice. Okay, so that's the Ramban. Dyed in the wool, Sfarad. At the same time, look how close he is, just geographically to France, and to again, there's no Germany, but what we would call Germany today. So the Ramban deals with both the Sephardic and Ashkenazic traditions that are known to him, and as we'll have a chance to look at a little. Part of his great contribution is his capacity to navigate both, let's say, the Ibn Ezra and Rashi, the Sephardic school and the Ashkenazic school, and at times even to synthesize them, okay, which is really unheard of before the advent of the Ramban's commentary. So what makes his commentary stand out? Let me say a couple things about it in a general way, and then I want to make a few specific points, and then we'll turn to the text itself to engage with it and see the lived text and commentary of the Ramban. So one of the first things to notice about the Ramban is that unlike Rashi, which is functionally a line by line commentary to the text, the Ramban wrote essays. The Ramban wasn't just writing comments. He thought about much broader issues and much broader topics. So one way to think about what the Ramban is doing is he's getting out of the weeds. Sometimes he's in the weeds, but he's also able to get out of the weeds, rise up, above the tree line, 30,000 feet, and look at a big picture analysis of what's going on in the text. To think about larger issues over the course of a particular parsha, over the course of a particular book. Noteworthy that, we said we had to search high and low for Rashi's purpose in writing his commentary because he didn't write an introduction to the Torah. The Ramban writes an introduction to the Torah, and he writes an introduction to every book of the Torah, which is itself an extraordinary contribution. We're not going to get into it tonight, but the Ramban's introduction to the Torah is not an introduction to his commentary. It's an introduction to the Torah. What an amazing contribution. You're opening up this book and you say, well, where did it come from? Who wrote it? How was it written? When was it written? What's it about? What are the themes? What does it mean? What's its relevance to me? The Ramban is interested in those bigger picture questions, and he addresses them head on in his introduction. And he's always picking up on those threads throughout his commentary. Okay. Now, again, if I use Rashi as a touchstone or as a reference point, it's because Ramban uses Rashi as a touchstone and a reference point. As I mentioned last week, already in Rashi's lifetime, it was almost to be expected that when you talked about Torah, you talked about Chumash, it meant that you talked about Chumash and Rashi. And by the time we get to Ramban, he's thinking about Chumash with Rashi and Chumash with Ibn Ezra, the groundwork has been laid by those two commentaries for Ibn Ezra, for Ramban to come along and do something, and do something much, much bigger. So we'll see tonight that one important difference is that we'll say this formulation, I think, is accurate, that we could say that Ramban is much less sympathetic to Midrashic literature than Rashi. So Rashi uses both. He's interested in Medrash and he's interested in Pshat. And the Ramban is perfectly aware of both and he's perfectly accepting of both, but he's much more aggressive. And we'll see an example of this where he says, I don't find the Medrash compelling. Let me tell you the Pshat. We'll see an example. So the four points I want to make about the Ramban before we jump into the text are these. The first is this notion of the big picture, and specifically the philosophical elements that can be derived from the text, the philosophical elements that get stirred up by engagement with the text. Okay, let me just share with you a quote from Rav Shavel, who was the, you know, that blue translation, that original, I think, from the 50s, still remains the classic translation of the Ramban. He writes the following. He says, there is no major problem that does not occupy his attention. Creation, man, the nature of the human soul, freedom of will, providence, miracles, both apparent and concealed, the roots of Israel's history is reflected in the lives of the patriarchs, the uniqueness of the land of Israel, all these and others come to light in this work. In the back of his mind, and again, this is sort of beyond what we can manage in one class in the Ramban, but in the back of his mind is all of Greek philosophy and a critique, an opposition, a critique of and an opposition to Greek philosophy that was, you know, quite prevalent in the Rambam's in the Rambam's milieu, and the Ramban is much less willing in his philosophical outlook to accept the suppositions of Greek philosophy. Okay, so point number one, Ramban didn't write a book of, you know, philosophical truths or a book of philosophical commentary on Judaism. The closest thing he did was write a commentary to the Torah, which almost doubles as his philosophical commentary to Judaism. Point number two, and this really can't be stressed enough. Point number two is that the Ramban was immersed, totally immersed in Kabbalah. He was a Kabbalist of the highest rank. And he does something that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he does something that no one had ever done before, which is use the Kabbalah in an incorporated, integrated way in writing a commentary to the Torah. So you open up a Perush HaRamban on the Torah, and you're reading along, and it's making perfect sense, and then you get to a line, or two, or five, or 10, and your head starts to spin. It's like, I don't understand anything I just read. I'm reading the words, and I'm reading them, and they make no sense to me. And the Ramban says in his introduction, expect this to happen. And he says, I'm going to include not just pshat and not just drash, but also mysticism, Kabbalah. And when you get, he says, when you get to those lines in my commentary, just skip that. If you are not initiated, if you have not been taught by a master of Kabbalah, they're not going to make any sense to you. Just skip them because they're not for you and they're going to be meaningless. So first, it's important to know that it was rare to find this kind of integration, to find a Talmudist and a Halachist who was also a Kabbalist and who also legitimated the study of Kabbalah. And some scholars actually say, and they make a pretty compelling case, that the Ramban was responsible in his generation for the popularization of Kabbalah because he democratized it, he legitimated it. It's not in a cave somewhere. It's in, you know, it's not a book because we don't have books yet, but it's in a manuscript. And I'm just the same way I pull out the Rashi manuscript to understand, you know, Parshas Lech Lecha, I pull out the Ramban and look at that. Right in the middle of the Ramban is a quote of, you know, a Kabbalistic source. So he popularized the notion that Kabbalah could be studied. One way to think about it is that he was interested in whetting the appetite of his readers, which again, we know from contemporary times, you get a sense that, well, there's something really deep here. There's something really important going on. I don't know what it is. If I just learned more, I could know something on a deeper level at another dimension. He gives the reader a taste, a kind of vorspeise of what Kabbalah looks like. I want to say two more things about Kabbalah. One is part of a much larger conversation, and that's about how to date the Zohar. But in academic circles, the historians say that the Zohar is basically contemporaneous with the Ramban, probably a little later. So the Zohar doesn't figure at all in the commentary of the Ramban, certainly not explicitly, because he didn't have it. That being said, there are many Kabbalistic works that predate the Zohar that the Ramban certainly did have access to, and those figure prominently in his commentary. I want to say one just very quick footnote to this point, and that is a famous saying that the Ramban popularized, which we'll actually see that comes out in Parshas Lech Lecha really for the first time, which is Maisa Avos Siman Labanim. This notion that what happened to the patriarchs prefigures, foreshadows what happens later on in the Torah and later on in Jewish history. So, you know, we're not going to look at it tonight, but it's in our Parsha. You know, so Sarah gets kidnapped by Paro after Avraham and Sarah come to Egypt. And eventually there's Paro is struck by plagues. And Paro returns Sarai to Avram, and they leave with great wealth. Ramban says that's a prefigurement of the Exodus story, right? The Jewish people were, separated from their wives, as the Haggadah tells us. Zum Precious, right? That famous Rashi at the beginning of Shmos. And Paro kidnapped, right? He enslaved, and then ultimately there were Negayim, there were Makos, and then the Jewish people ended up leaving with great wealth and headed toward Canaan. So prefigurements of the same story. So the little asterisk, the little note that I want to say is my strong, strong suspicion, for reasons I'm not going to get into tonight, is that that concept is really only comprehensible in the world of mysticism. There's so much determinism that attaches to that concept that my strong suspicion is that it only makes sense to an initiated Kabbalist. Okay? So again, we could talk more about it, but I just wanted to note it because it's such a prominent mark of the Ramban's commentary, especially in Parshas Lech Lecha and Sefer Bereishis. So point number one, big philosophical issues. Point number two, the Ramban integrates Kabbalah into his commentary along with Pshat and Drash. Point number three is a smaller point, but is also very important, and that is his willingness to criticize biblical heroes, the notion that they make mistakes and there's no whitewashing them. This is a great debate in Chazal, right? The Gemara says, right, if you say that David HaMelech sinned, you're mistaken. What do you mean? The text says that David HaMelech sinned. So why am I mistaken if that's what the Navi tells me? Right. So there's streams of thought, and it's not even just two schools of thought. It's a whole spectrum about how to read these kinds of narratives in Tanakh, right? And is someone going to have the willingness to say that our greatest heroes, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, made mistakes? And the Ramban says, yeah, count me in. We're going to see an example, at least one. Tonight, where, you know, again, it has great resonance for us in the modern period, where yeah, we want to come to terms with the truth, and we don't want to whitewash anything, and this is not a hagiography, this is the real thing, and we want to see the warts and all of it. So the Ramban says, yeah, I'm going to show you the mistakes, and we're going to talk about that. Final point, and then I want to delve into the Ramban's commentary itself. Is the centrality of the land of Israel from beginning to end in the commentary of the Ramban. And hopefully we'll have time, we'll see an example of this. but in the back of Ramban's mind, and again, he lived it, which is really extraordinary. What did it take in 1267 to get from, you know, Catalonia to Palestine at a time when there's no extant Jewish community in Jerusalem? So amazing that he actually lived that dream, but it comes through in his commentaries all the time. And again, hopefully we'll have a chance to see an example. So let's jump in. I want to, if we have time, I want to share with you five brief comments of the Ramban in Parshas Lech Lecha, so we can see some of the notes that I've made about the Ramban come to life in his commentary itself. Before we do, I just want to share an excerpt with you from the Ramban's introduction to Sefer Bereishis. The very end, as I mentioned, the Ramban's introductions are not introductions to his commentaries, they're introductions to the books. So at the very end of his commentary, his introduction to the book of Bereishis, he says just like one line about his commentary. It's his kind of programmatic statement. So if you have the text in front of you, this is source number one. On your source sheets, I'll also bring it up just so you can see it in case you don't have the source sheet in front of you. It's source number one on the source sheet. The Ramban writes the following. He says, "V'ata da'ur ma'ashiv sho'alei davar b'ksivas perish ha'Torah." He says, "What am I going to answer to those who say, well, why'd you write this commentary to the Torah?" So he says, nothing ambitious. I'm just doing what people always do. The Rishonim, the Kadmonim, you know, those who came before me, which is to write a commentary for the reader. The reader who is a student, who is oppressed under these difficult times of the diaspora, right? As I mentioned, right, there's no Jewish community living in Palestine, virtually no community. The Jewish people have been in exile for, you know, 1,200 years at this point. And I want to give them a means by which to access the text. They're reading the text, they're reading the Chumash, he says, on Shabbos and Yantiv, and I want to help them along by giving them some explanations, what he calls pshatim, some explanations of the text, uviktsast varim ne'imim l'shomim u'liyodin chayin, and some nice explanations which will be pleasant and pleasing to those who read them. So, again, he's understating the case because he gives his reader something much more. And then he goes on to say, and by the way, when you get to the Kabbalah pieces of my commentary, unless you're an initiate, you know, steer clear. Okay. So I'm going to try to make five points in the time that we have remaining to bring to life the points that I've tried to bring up to this moment. So let's jump into source number two. I'll just leave the source sheet up so you could see it, and then I'll close it periodically. And this comes back to the point I was making about the Ramban's commentary in Kabbalah, and my supposition that when the Ramban says Maisa Avo Simon Labanim, he really is talking about something that belongs to the world of Kabbalah. But let's say that. Let's see what he does say. So the Torah tells us when Abraham got to Canaan, Vayavor Abraham be'eretz ad mekom shechem, that when Abraham got to Canaan, he went as far as Shechem. So he says, Omer lecha, I want to just tell you klal, tavina so b'chol ha'parshios ha'baos b'inyan Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. I want to tell you, and this is very eye-catching, because he says, I want to tell you a general rule that applies for the rest of the book. Through all the lives of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, all the patriarchs, who in Yan Gadol, it's a big deal, right? Hiskiru Rabbeinu b'derech k'tzara. He says, you know, the Medrash mentions this in a shorthand way. V'amru, and they say in the Medrash, Kol ma she'ira la'avos siman labanim. everything that happens to the patriarchs is a kind of prefigurement to their children, and not just in the Torah, but for all time. So he famously says, I'll give you an example, again, from our Parsha, Rashi, Avraham goes to war to save his nephew Lot in the war of the four kings against the five kings. So Avraham is on the side of the five kings, and he has to battle the wicked four kings. They're the enemy four kings. The Ramban says that's all Jewish history. Jewish history is a battle against the four kingdoms, the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans that are responsible, you know, for the oppression of the Jewish people. So that's not just Tanakh, that's 3,000 years of Jewish history. But the first time he says it, the first introduction to this principle is here in our Parsha, Kol mi she'ir la'avo simon labanim, and that's why the Ramban says, V'lachen yarifu ha'ksuvim b'sipor ha'masos ha'chafiros ha'be'eros v'shar ha'mikrim. There's all these details, right? And he's answering a very important question, which is, we need to know about who dug the wells and where they, you know, pitched their tent and all these, you know, seemingly minor details in the biblical account. Every verse is so valuable. Why is the Torah taking up so much attention on these particular details? He says, the whole purpose of this, kulam ba'im lelamed al ha'atid. All of this is to tell you something about the future. So I just want to leave it at that for now. But just to place in its context this very important principle, Maisa Avo Simon Labanim, which the Ramban introduces in our parsha. Okay. So now I want to come back to the notion I mentioned a moment ago about the controversy, the ongoing debate within Chazal about how to read difficult passages in the Torah, in Tanakh, when it seems like someone that is a tzaddik, for lack of a better term, did something problematic, did something that they weren't supposed to do. So let's just jump into the Parsha for a second. So you have this in sources number 3, 4, 5. So the Torah tells us, "Vayi Rav ba'aretz, vayered Avram Mitzrayim la'gorsham ki chaved ha'rav ba'aretz." So it's really amazing, right? What happens to Avram? Hashem says lech lecha, and Avram gets up and he leaves. And he goes from Ur Kasdim to Canaan. And as soon as he gets to Canaan, it's supposed to be the promised land, right? As soon as he gets there, famine. What does famine mean in biblical times? Famine means not just like, okay, we're going to have to, cut back on our consumption. No, famine means life or death situation because there is no food. Okay. So what do you do in a famine? So Rashi says, in source number 4, let me give you the backstory. Rav Ba'aretz. So if you read carefully, what the Torah is telling you is that there was a famine in that land, okay, just in that specific spot. It wasn't a trans-regional, transnational, you know, famine. It was a local famine. Ba'osa aretz levada. L'nasoso imihar achar devarav shal kodesh baruch hu shamlu leches al aretz kanan v'achshav masiu letzeis mimena. And it was a kind of test. Rashi says it was a kind of test because, you know, God had said, go to the land. As soon as he gets to the land, it's not sustainable. He can't stay there. Now, look what the Ramban says. The Ramban is very harsh. We just met Avram, by the way, 2 minutes ago. We just got to him. We haven't even established his tzidkus. And the Ramban, right at the beginning of the introduction of the Torah to Avram, says, Vedaki Avram Avinu chata chet gadol bishkaga. Was unintentional, but he sinned a great sin. So this whole story, what does Avram do? He leaves Canaan with Sarai and he travels to Egypt. And the Ramban takes him to task. The Ramban says, he's putting his wife in mortal danger. And it wasn't like some far-flung, unforeseeable risk. it happened, right? The danger that was foreseeable actually transpired. That's the rest of the story. Paro kidnaps Sarah, right? And it could have been it could have been terribly, terribly tragic. So the Ramban has no qualms about pointing out and saying in explicit terms when the avos and imahos make make mistakes, naming those mistakes and calling them chataim. And you have it later in you know, also in our parsha, when in source number six, again, not not for right now, but the whole business with you know, how Sarah treated Hagar, the Ramban says mistake by Sarah, mistake by Abraham, mistake, chait, right? It's a problem. So that is the that's the second point that I want to make. Maisa Avos Simon Labanim, the issue of the signs of the fathers prefiguring what happens later in the story and maybe in Jewish history. Point number two, the Ramban says you have to call it like it is. If someone has transgressed, maybe it's an accident, maybe it's unintentional, whatever the case may be, call it like it is. And we're not above saying that that even great people can make mistakes. And again, this resonates with us moderns, because you know, we like to say we're not angels, and neither were the avos and imahos. What makes them great is that they made mistakes because they're human, and they were great in spite of their mistakes, or because of their mistakes, they integrated them, they learned from them, they improved upon them, they did tshuva, whatever the rest of the story is, right? That is a working assumption of the Ramban. Okay. I mentioned earlier that that the Ramban starts with you know, starts with Rashi and Ibn Ezra, and that as a general rule, the Ramban is much less willing to accept Medrash at face value, and is much more interested in Pshat. So I want to learn a little sugya with you. To read just two psukim, to look at how Rashi interprets those psukim, which is probably the way we learned the story when we were in, I want to say second grade, maybe not first, but maybe second grade, and then look at how the Ramban takes apart the story and puts it back together. Okay, so I'm not going to put it up on the screen because I prefer to see people's faces, but if you have the source sheet, it's number 7. If you have a chumash, it's Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Zayin. You know the psukim by heart, so you don't have to go scrounging after a chumash if it's not handy. The pasuk says the following: Vayhi Riv Ben Ro'e Mikne Avram Uben Ro'e Mikne Lot V'haknani V'haprizi Az Yoshev Ba'aretz. Do you remember the story? The story is that there is a dispute. There's a dispute between the shepherds of Abram and the shepherds of Lot. Vayhiriv ben ro'e mikne Abram ben ro'e mikne Lot. And then the pasuk, the second half of the pasuk, is like a non sequitur. V'haknani v'haprisi az yoshev ba'aretz. The Canaanites and the Prizites lived in the land. Okay. I always think of the, you know, 21st century parallel. We took a road trip from New York City to Canada. And when we got there, you'll never guess who was living there, the Canadians. Who did you expect was living in Canaan, if not the Canaanites? Right? So the Canaanites and the Prizites are living in the land? What does that have to do with the price of tea in China? And why are you telling it to me, right, on the heels of the description of this debate between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot? Okay, you remember the rest of the story. Avram says to Lot, you know, we shouldn't be a fight between us. Let's separate, okay? Fine. So everyone has to grapple with the story here. Why were they fighting? Out of nowhere, the shepherds start fighting. So Rashi quotes the Medrash. Do you remember the Medrash? It's in source number 8. Yeah. Describe it in the interest of time. Rashi says there was a very sensible dispute between the shepherds. What was the dispute? The dispute was the shepherds of Avram made sure to muzzle their livestock, and the shepherds of Lot did not. So why the dispute? Why the different philosophies of the shepherds? So Rashi, again, quoting the Medrash, says in the Medrash, the author of the Medrash is very careful readers of the text. So there's a promise. There's a promise that's been made to Abraham. The promise is that the land is going to belong to Abraham. So Rashi says, based on the Medrash, you know what the dispute is? The dispute is whether or not the land currently belongs to Abraham. So Abraham's shepherds say, this is a promise for the future. The land doesn't belong to us. We have to muzzle our livestock. And the shepherds of Lot say, look around, man. The man, Abraham, however old he is, he's at the end of his life. He has no children. The land is promised to him. His heir is his nephew. In which case, we're just fast-forwarding the story. The land is destined to belong to Lot in a matter of time. It's a foregone conclusion. And if that's the case, then we can just presume that if the land is going to belong to him in the future, it belongs to him now, in which case there's no criminal act in allowing our livestock to graze in pasture lands with no muzzle. And Rashi says, now I can explain to you the second half of that pasuk, which made no sense. V'akasuv omer v'aknani v'aprisi az yoshev ba'aretz v'lo zacha ba'Avraham adai. The Rashi says the second half of the pasuk explains or actually decides the debate. To whom does the land belong? It's going to be Avraham's. Does that mean it's his now? So the pasuk, Rashi says, it decides. It just decided the whole debate. No. The land belongs to the Canaanites and the Perizzites. They're still in the land, so it's not yet Abraham's, in which case it's not yet Lot's, in which case Abraham's shepherds have the stronger case to do anything other than to muzzle the livestock is to be guilty of theft. That's Rashi. Sound familiar? Right? That's the Medrash, that's the Rashi, probably the way we learned it when we were in grade school. Now the Ramban. Ramban quotes Rashi, and he says, that's a midrashic explanation, you know, that's a medrash, that's perfectly plausible. But he says, I want to give you a pshat explanation. Okay, as I mentioned last week, our working definition of pshat is an ability to read the text in the context of the text without recourse to medrash. Using just the information that's known to us in the text itself. So the Ramban says, and you can see this at the end of source number 9. He says, "Valderach pshat haisah miriva al hamir'eh." He says, "What do shepherds fight about? Shepherds fight about pasture land. Ki lo nasa usam ha'aretz. There just wasn't enough in the text, right? It's known to us." In the aftermath of that story with Paro. So there's huge, huge amount of wealth that Avram and Lot have. They have such enormous amount of livestock. The land is not big enough to sustain all of their herds. Kasher hayam bikne Avram ro'eh ba'achu. Hayam ro'eh Lot ba'im bigulam ve'ro'im sham. And they started, the shepherds of Lot started encroaching on the boundaries that Abraham's shepherds had set. And this is the point the Ramban says. Abraham and Lot were just sojourners in the land. They owned nothing. And this, the Ramban says, is the explanation for the second half of the pasuk. The Canaanites and the Perizzites were in the land. They were still in the land. And if they were still in the land, it's because the land belonged to them. And so the Ramban goes on to say, if the land belonged to them, expanding the borders and grazing on land that wasn't theirs was in fact to place Avraham, Lot, and their respective families in grave danger, because they were all soon to be guilty of theft by grazing in lands that didn't belong to them. So the Ramban goes on to say, who knows what the Canaanites and Perizzites could have done? They could have attacked them. They could have killed them. Whatever the fear was, that was a real that was a real fear. And that's why Abraham said, you go right, I'll go left. You go left, I'll go right. But this is not a workable solution if our two flocks are grazing in the same spot. We're going to place ourselves in grave danger. A pshat explanation, no recourse to Medrash that reinterprets the text in a way that makes it perfectly readable and perfectly plausible, again, without having to resort to Medrash. Okay, I want to make two final points before we wrap up. The penultimate point that I want to make is about the land of Israel. As I mentioned in the first half, in the introduction, the Ramban always has an eye on Israel. Always the promised land, and he always wants his readers to remember that Israel is the promised land. And just as, Jewish history has demonstrated time and time again, diaspora and exile lead to salvation and return. Diaspora and exile will lead to salvation and return once again. Keep your eye on the prize. Remember that Israel is, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So again, laced throughout the commentary, I'll just give you one example because it's in our parsha. In the war against the four kings, the four kings against the five. So Avraham is victorious, and there's an epilogue to the story, and we meet a man called Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem. We never heard of Malki Tzedek, we never heard of Shalem, we have no idea who this man is, or where he's from, or what his relevance is in the text. We'll save it for another time. It's an amazing story. But the Ramban offers just one simple observation about who this man is and why he's relevant. So the Torah tells us, just a couple lines, Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem Hotzi Lechem V'Yayin V'Hu Kohen La'El Elyon. He came at the end of the battle. He wasn't one of the kings. He's not on the team of the four. He's not on the team of the five. We never heard of him. He shows up at the end. They're starting to think about dividing the spoils. He shows up with bread and wine. And the Torah tells us that he is a Kohen La'El Elyon, some kind of religious man, some kind of priest, maybe even a monotheist, who knows. And the Ramban, Johnny on the spot, jumps in and says, I just want to tell you who this man is. And he says that Shalem, just know that Shalem is Yerushalayim. Just know that Shalem is Yerushalayim. And at this moment, we should be thinking about Jerusalem and Israel. From time immemorial, we've never heard of it, right? Jerusalem's not named in the Torah, but it was known. It was known in like a kind of a primordial way. It was known even among the nations that this place, that this spot that we know as Shalem, as Yerushalayim, that was a spiritual place, that was a godly place, that was a holy place, and everybody knew it. As shiadu ma'alaso b'kabbalah shehu mechuvan keneged beit hamikdash shalmala. Amazing. It was like this Kabbalah, not in the mystical sense, but there was a received tradition that this spot rested opposite the heavenly base Hamikdash. So again, you could have read the text without this comment of the Ramban, but whenever there's an opportunity, the Ramban slips in references to Yerushalayim, to Israel, to its holiness, and to the sense that it is inextricably bound up with the destiny of the Jewish people. In the last 4 minutes, I'll just conclude with one final thought. You have it here in source number 12 and source number 13. After the war of the four kings and the five kings, Hashem appears to Abraham. Achar hadvarim ha'ela yadavar Hashem el Abraham b'machazel leimor. Al tira Abraham anochim agen lach, svarcha harbe miod. He appears to Avraham in a dream, in a vision, and he says, Avraham, don't be afraid. I will protect you. Your reward will be very great. And everyone throws up their arms. Like, if you're telling somebody, don't be afraid, it must be because they're afraid. So Avraham is a great warrior, right? He just, if not for him, right, this war would have kept on going. He saved his nephew successfully. So he doesn't seem like a fearful guy. If anything, he seems like a man of great courage and great action. So why does Avraham need a reassurance from God? Altir Avraham, don't be nervous, don't be afraid. And the Ramban writes a beautiful, like, philosophical treatise. And again, you can read it on your own, source number 13, when there's more time. But he says this is in the nature of tzaddikim. Tzaddikim understand that their reward is in the world to come, and that what comes to them in this world is not a reflection of their tzidkus. And so they always walk around with this fear. Maybe something that I've done wrong, maybe some sin that I've committed knowingly, unknowingly, what have you, will cause me to receive some kind of punishment in this world that isn't quite measure for measure, that's not quite deserved. And Avraham, in the wake of this battle, was walking around with such a fear. And this is the piece with which I began when I introduced the points about the Ramban, and the notion that he never wrote a book of Jewish philosophy, but his commentary to the Torah is his book of Jewish philosophy. So here's his introduction. Here's a comment. Here's a little essay. You're just the reader on Shabbos morning trying to understand what happened after the battle of the four kings against the five in the life of Abraham. And the Ramban stops you in your tracks and says, I just want to introduce you to a few important Jewish concepts like Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba and Schar and Onesh and Tzadik Viralo and Theodicy and what is reward and punishment look like in this world compared to the next world. And over the course of his commentary, right, if you put the pieces together and add them up, you have whole treatises, whole arguments about all of these issues that belong to this school of Jewish philosophy that the Ramban was preaching in 13th century Spain. So here we have, right, this amazing integration of Pshat, Drash, and Kabbalah, which leaves the reader feeling enriched, not just on a technical level, but on a 30,000 foot level, to see the broadest terms what it is that the Torah is communicating to us, and to see the forest from the trees. So I'll stop here because we're out of time. But please God, we'll be able to pick up next week, as I mentioned, on Election Day. Take your mind off the election for an hour and join us between 8 and 9 Tuesday election day evening. I'll stay on for a couple minutes if anyone has questions. But thank you again for joining us, and look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Excellent, Rabbi.